Hello, everyone. Welcome to the TSMU Q&A series. So excited to be back with you all for another week. I am your host, Emily Kroll. I am the marketing manager over at Lenovo Legion. And today we are joined by a wonderful and super special guest, Data. He is our R6 coach for TSM. Jake, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Doing great, thank you. So excited to have you here, and everyone is super excited to ask you questions. We've already got a ton of questions queued up, but we will be pulling questions from the TSMU Discord. So if you do have a question for Jake, head to discord.gg/TSMU and ask your question in the Q&A questions channel. So while some questions are rolling in, Data, why don't you let us know a little bit about yourself and what you do in your role as the coach for Rainbow Six?
I am Data, the strategic coach for TSMR6. I used to be the analyst for Space Station Gaming, former world champions. Do a lot of strategic development and analytics for Rainbow Six. I do application developments, tools development. So like I have a website for being able to display stats for a team, as well as like all the analytics, but I'll add in stuff like tools to help develop strats faster, to be able to display information faster, to do breakdowns a lot better. I do individual player developments and just pretty much whatever coach can't do as the head coach, I try to do. We try and divvy things up together. Yeah, pretty much it. I'm not necessarily stuck in Siege, though, so I do look at other esports and try and enjoy them. I think my favorite esport is League of Legends, and that's just because it's a lot cleaner and a lot more professional, but I don't know.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure there will be some questions about that, and we're going to learn a whole lot about what you do day in and day out at TSM. So let's dive right on into the questions. The first one we have here is from Ricky, and he asks, when it comes to attacking a site, do you guys teach strategy? Do you have a direct plan that everyone needs to follow, or is it more free flow and reactionary based on the defender setup?
I think that's a good question, because I think when it comes to attack versus defense, it's a lot easier to see defenses structured for attack to be a lot more free flowing and like there to be a lot more pieces. So it's understandable to like not necessarily know if strategy is involved when it comes to planning for an attack round. But we always go in with some form of plan, though it is typically a mixture of structure and free flowing. When it comes to attacking a map, typically in Siege, there's certain areas of control that you want to try and get. And I think typically you'll have like a default way to do things. Like you'll want to enter in like through X, Y, and Z, like through certain doors, through certain windows to gain certain control. And that's why like a lot of attack rounds will look very like similar in the beginning. But we do practice strategy for like, let's say we wanted to take like a certain room and we needed to clear a certain utility before we could take that room. We will practice and we will go through like the utility that we have to clear that room. So it is a bit of both in that sense. It just comes down to the prioritization of what areas are important. And that's the decisions that the players have to make. So it is like a little bit of a mix.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you for that answer. We have got plenty more questions here, so I'm going to keep rolling. Madman has the next question, and he asks, for your strats and what you do, do you work with the team or do it solo, and then they comment on it?
So typically, the strats are developed on the support staff side of things. We've had sessions where we will work with the players to develop something based off like an idea that an individual player has. But most often it will come from Poach and I, or just like one or the other, like feeding off, like even like we might do it together, we might do it independently. Oftentimes we'll start with an idea that one person has, and then the other will come in halfway through and give a little bit of feedback and work together on it. But it typically will come from us, And then when we go through dry runs, which is where we'll typically like practice a new strat, that's when the player feedback will come in. And then we'll take that into the scrim in the day and just kind of take feedback off that as well.
Awesome. And I'm sure each player is bringing their own unique skill set to the table in each scenario as well.
Yeah. They all have like different aggressive levels, and how they want to play out a round is going to be different based off their personality and how they think that the game should be played.
Exactly. Awesome. Well, thank you. We've got another question from Pegasus, who asks, how does one go about implementing machine learning and deep analytics? Is it just a faster way to collect stats similar to R6 Analyst? There's more to this question, but I'm going to let you answer that part first.
So this is one that I can't necessarily get too deep into, just because it's like everything is a competitive edge that you can have as far as breaking down a process. But we do have data scraping, which is what R6 Analyst does. R6 Analyst is a client-side scraping. So like you install the software, it'll take it from your specific point of view. But it is typically like base level stats feedback, similar with CCG. Whereas we do deep learning, it's fairly difficult to implement for like individual matches. We have done it before. Typically it will be used in a broader sense for like going into an event or trying to do like meta analysis and breaking that down. Or like when we do like SI prep, we will always break down like individual teams and look at their like overall like team play style based off of deep analysis. But individual maps become a little bit harder because as we've gone into best of ones with only 7 matches, it reduces the sample size for an individual team. Before though, we could do stuff like back when I was on SSG was whenever I was like first pioneering a lot of the tools that I used, and we had lost at Raleigh up against Team Secret in just like a very aggressive manner. And so I like basically like had a decent sample size because they played a bunch, and I was able to find like their like rush rating, like how often they were going to rush based off of like the prep phase, like the 6-pick timer. Like if they 6-picked immediately and like their opposing team had 6-picked immediately, it would show me if they were going to rush or not with like an 80-something% success rate, which is interesting, but we're kind of past that time, at least for now.
Cool. I had no idea how much you could predict. So the second part of the question was, are you looking for something specific? I think you answered that a little bit. Are the stats similar to what Siege.gg or R6 Analyst produce?
So you do have those baseline stats, but with Siege.gg is hand-picked data, and R6 Analyst is typically just like the kill, like kills from the scoreboard, like that information. But we take a little bit more as far as being able to look at plant denials, being able to look at like weapons, being able to look at like we like track the kill feed, which allows us to see like the times of kills. Whereas a lot of those sites don't take care of that other than the opening kill, opening death, and like when the round ends. So we do get a little bit more in depth when it comes to comparing ourselves to CCG and R6 Analyst.
That's pretty awesome. Thank you. We have another question from Ricky up next. He asks, when it comes to communication, is there a dedicated person to give call-outs once they're dead, so not all 4 people are screaming the same call-out?
That's an understandable question. Typically, how we roll it is, and this is a little bit more recent, because we have had, like, typically, like, our communication isn't bad, but we will run into it, like every team will run into eventually, like get communication like floods. So how we work it is, if someone's dead and they're on a camera, even if they're alive, if whoever's controlling the camera has communication when it comes to like giving a call out when they're dead. So like, let's say you have 2 cams up, typically like you'll have like those 2 people that are dead able to communicate. And then if someone's talking about like the flow of the round that isn't like just like detailed information, then it'll typically be the IGL, or it'll be like whoever, like we have like a pre-round IGL, mid-round, and execute. Those can be the same person or different people depending on the map or depending on the season. But typically we'll have Matt like giving it like an overall flow depending on how he sees the round breaking down if he's dead.
Awesome. It's like the little things that you don't always think about first, right? Next question is coming in from Pegasus, and he asks, what's your day-to-day schedule like, and what's the day-to-day schedule for the team?
I think that depends mostly on the time of year. So like we have basically, I would say, 3 to 4 schedules, depending on if it's the main season, if it's like pre-tournament prep, or if we're like dirt, like in the middle of a tournament. Our main season, we scrim 6 times a day. I think we do now roughly 50% of those are double scrims. We used to do more, but finding scrims in North America have been quite hard, like consistently. So oftentimes our day schedule will typically be VOD review / drills and dry runs into scrims, into post scrim VOD review, and then like a double scrim would typically be the same, but a little bit reduced down on how much we dry run and how much we drill in the beginning. And then mine typically starts with data collection and then some development. I'll try and do some code cleanup and then get into like the team schedule, where I'll do like a lot of analytics and a lot of breakdowns while they're doing scrims, and like we'll do like scrim feedback reports I'll try and take part of.
Awesome. So do you feel like you have a fun day to day? Each and every day is like new challenges, or does it tend to get a little bit repetitive at times, or is it a mixture of both?
It can be a mixture of both. A lot of the pre-tournament can be very tiresome because I'll do a lot more of the like scouting for a tournament. So a lot of it gets very repetitive as you're watching like 10 hours of maps a day, and then you're going into practice for like 6 to 8 hours and not really enjoying it.
So. Yes. Blue light glasses all around.
Yeah.
Blue light glasses for everyone. Okay, I'm seeing in the chat, Pegasus is writing in the Twitch chat that the questions are from Ohio State team that he's written here. So I will credit the Ohio State R6 team for your questions, Pegasus. Our next question, however, is coming in from Cowfee. When you have an execute in mind before the round starts, but a key player of the execute dies before the execute can go through, how does the team adapt?
So a lot of the execute, so we do something that not a lot of other teams do, which is called drills. And essentially that is Poge and I and one other player essentially practicing, like we'll defend and execute. So like they have to like clear a certain section of the map, or it'll be like more often than not, it's an execute. And we'll try and go through different scenarios. We'll take certain players out and like feed them in based on like their importance. And that oftentimes will lead to like a lot of like questions whenever like we'll try and like we'll have them try and execute on us. And we'll notice like this isn't working out or this is working out. And like we'll kind of give feedback on like what we could do differently. So when it comes to the actual like practice for it, a lot of the time like it is something that we've like prepared for to some degree. So like typically you'll look at like an execute losing like the hard breacher before you can get the wall open, or like losing like a player that's supposed to wedge the side open and they don't end up doing it. When it comes to the actual players communicating, oftentimes it just comes down to like it comes down to the individual round, what they see, like what they see, what they don't see will oftentimes like pivot around that. So like they'll clear a certain utility and then a person dies, like now they know at least like what utility isn't there and what is there, like what that means, and kind of pivot off of that. But it definitely comes down to the players in that regard, like as far as making it work out, which oftentimes they end up doing, which is always good. But we've definitely seen a lot of shortcomings lately as far as like last stage losing those pivotal players and not being able to push off of it. Mm-hmm. So this stage we're trying to prep a little bit more around that and build a little bit more towards better understanding of what to do in those situations.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like a timely question. And Ricky has clarified. I'm sorry. Did I cut you off?
No.
Okay. Ricky has clarified in the chat as well that his questions are coming from the DePaul University R6 team. So shout out to them as well. The next question is coming from them. For a new team trying to improve and play better, what would you say is the number one thing they need to improve or learn?
I would say the biggest thing for a team that's like just starting out, or like just like not necessarily like they're not where they want to be, is to be realistic with yourselves. It sounds like something that's like very like cliche, but oftentimes like you need to be able to look at where your changes need to come from. And oftentimes what teams will do is they'll see like, oh, we had a lot of success in this, so we shouldn't change that. But oftentimes when it comes into like trying to grow as a team, you have to be able to look at like your successes almost as failures, and like build off of those, if that makes sense. It sounds kind of counterintuitive, but I guess the be realistic is a lot more to work off of, and stick together. I think that's probably like a much easier, like a much quicker thing to bring in, is like a lot of tier 2, tier 3, tier 4 teams, they'll go through like a bad season, they'll have a bad tournament, and all of a sudden they're like, well, I don't want to play with this team because this happened in this event. And like, if you aren't able to work together, like that's the whole point of those tiers, is like Pro League is about being a good team, but it's about being such a good team that individuals can perform. Whereas the like tier 2, tier 3 are about becoming that good team, being able to be that good team player, and you can't ever do that if you're just moving to other teams. And I think that's something that a lot of Siege has struggles with, is kind of trying to be like you're trying to be a superstar player. You have to market yourself as an individual, but the reason why teams like won't pick up a tier 2 player often, more often than not, is not because of their individual performance, but because of their team performance.
Mm. I think you're giving some great life advice, just inherently here. And in the beginning, you mentioned about self-awareness and needing to look at your successes as failures. And I just want to kind of expand on that. Do you feel like there have been any instances in your career, maybe, where you've had to practice self-awareness, or that it has benefited you to look at your successes, maybe not so much as failures, but to learn from your successes and improve upon those?
Yeah, I think every season, like that's kind of how you want to take things, is you have to think of like, not necessarily, I guess, like for the high successes, like let's say we get like first in a split, or like us winning the major last year, is like as soon as you win something, people are now going to try and counter whatever that is. So whatever that success was then will become a failure next season if it's the only thing that you rely on. And I think that's something that like we always try and like build upon, is like whatever we did well, like if we're like a standout team against other teams in a stage or a season, is like whatever that is will likely be our undoing if it isn't like a core like attribute to work off of. But individually, I would say I was doing really well in a team before I joined TSM, and I guess the success was that I was good, but the failure was that like I wasn't doing what was best for myself. So like I worked with a team unpaid, like I didn't have like a paying contract for 11 months. And I think like it was a success in getting to that spot, being able to work with a professional team for that long, but that it was a failure because I worked that long without like taking care of myself. And I think that's like one of the shortcomings that a lot of people getting into the scene will do, is like they won't take care of themselves as like well as they should. They should like treat themselves better than the company that they work for is treating them. Yeah. And I think like that was something that like it got me here. It got me to a better place. It got me to respect myself a lot more. So it was a success that I think overall was a failure.
Awesome. That's great advice. And the silver lining, like you said, is that you're here now. You made it, and it's unfortunate. And I think you can, even just by what you just shared with us, you can help play a part in helping other people to realize when they might be in an unfortunate situation that they need to get themselves out of.
Yeah, most definitely. I think everybody can take from that.
For sure. For sure. Well, I want to remind you guys, since we're about 20 minutes in, that we are pulling questions from the TSMU Discord. So if you have questions for Data, head to discord.gg/TSMU and ask your question in the Q&A questions channel. Okay, on to some more questions for you. They are rolling in. Next one comes from Pegasus, Ohio State, I believe. If I got it wrong, you guys are going to flame me in the chat. So how does the team prep for a match? What does the team do to prep for majors or SI? I totally just butchered that.
I guess I'll go for generalizing to tournaments. Like I'll lump in the majors with SI. Oftentimes, we will prep every opponent at the event beforehand. And then from that, we have like a basic understanding of like the generalized meta for the event, because even though like globally, like Latin America's region will have like a certain meta, EU will have a certain meta, NA will have a certain meta. You have to like filter that out into the specific teams that are going to an event. So we'll break down like every team and then we'll kind of lump them together and try and like find that equalizer to find like how likely we are to play against like aggressive teams or just not like more strategic teams. And then when it comes to practice, like realistically, like we practice the most out of any team in North America, even if we've had rough results recently. Like we'll practice like 6 out of 7 days, we'll practice for extended hours, we'll do like certain things like the drills that not many other teams are doing right now. I think the only team that does something close to it would be Dark Zero for NA as far as drills, but theirs are slightly different. But realistically, like we prep and practice every match because you want to have that rhythm. You want to be able to like know what you're going into. You don't have to be like, all right, guys, now we're prepping for a tournament. It's going to be different. Like, it's not different. Like you want to like practice every match. Everybody's playing to win, so you're prepping every match to the best of your ability.
Absolutely. Awesome. Thank you for your answer. The next question we have here is from Ricky, aka DePaul University R6 team. They've asked, when you do VOD review, is there anything specific that you're looking for, or is it just an overall, this could have gone differently?
So VOD review, I guess all of my questions are always, it depends. It depends on the kind of VOD review. Sometimes we'll do individual VOD review with individual players. Sometimes VOD review will be introspective versus like looking at an opponent. Sometimes it'll be for data collection. Oftentimes we'll look through like a singular VOD multiple times over. If it is for like an upcoming opponent, oftentimes we're breaking down like their play style, how they want to take certain strats. So we'll look through different like takes on a site and just kind of look for those commonalities and try and see how they want to think throughout the match. When it comes to our own, which is what it sounds like you're referring to for like scrims, is oftentimes like you don't want to nitpick on like everything that's gone wrong in a round. Like you like want to talk over it just to like reinforce like, hey, like yeah, we understand like this was a mistake, but like we can work through it. But oftentimes we talk through like repetitive mistakes that happen, or like we give alternative feedback on a round. So like if someone held something a certain way and like it might have lost us the round, but it might not have been the wrong decision, we can still talk through those alternatives and be like, well, you held this here and it was great, it gave us this intel and like we lost the gunfight, but like you could have done this, you could have worked with the teammate here, you could have called someone here, and it's possible that we would have shut them down a little bit harder than we did. So it really depends on the kind of bot review, but oftentimes it isn't like we're just like, oh, well, like that happens, like mistakes happen, because they do happen. But it's a lot more on those like discussions, because those discussions typically lead to more thought than just like just being like, oh yeah, you guys like screwed up here, like
right.
Doesn't really give you much. Whereas if you talk about like, well, like you did this and this was correct, you give positive reinforcement on decision making that was made, but then you also provide alternates to work off of.
Right. Yeah, that's where the real value is. The solutions.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. Yes, he's spitting as people are saying in the chat. Everyone's really excited about today's Q&A. So thank you all for being here. And thank you, Data, for being here. Everyone is really loving it, seemingly, from the chat. Our next question comes in from Lucky, who is the competitive coordinator of R6 at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. I'm sure I pronounced all of that wrong. But they've asked, is there a solid way of creating synergy with a new team? We get new rosters every year due to the players leaving because of college classes.
As far as, it's very hard to, like, you don't necessarily know if a team is going to work until it works or it doesn't work. When it comes to the, like, tier one level, realistically, like, you have to be open to making, like, you have to be able to make changes as a team and as an individual. I think the biggest thing for, like, I guess, like, a brand new team, like, if you're had, like, you're forced to swap, like, players in and out, is be willing to put people, like, being willing to put, like, people that are supports on flex roles, be willing to put them on entry roles, like, give them, like, a chance to, like, find new things, because as you work together, like, you're able to, like, naturally kind of create, like you let, like, the players essentially, like, see how they do in, like, a certain situation in, like, in a given role. The other thing would be doing, like, if you can try and implement drills. I know not many teams are able to do it, but I'm assuming, like, with a college that you're going to have a head coach, potentially, like, an analyst or a secondary coach, being able to take, like, two VXs and, like, try and, like, work those out, they're, like, a nice casual way to, like, have your players talk through solutions as you, like, you'll go through, like, the same execute, like, 30 times over. And, yeah, I don't know if that works or not. Oh, we're back. We'll sit through, like, half an hour of just, like, a singular site, and just kind of try and, like, talk through it all. And I think, like, that helps a lot as far as, like, having, like, everybody kind of communicate, like, how they want to flow through a map. But as far as, like, overall synergy, I have no idea as far as, like, being forced to create synergy. Oftentimes, like, it's just something that happens over time.
So you guys don't sit around and do the icebreaker games that you have to do at the start of classes or the start of a new job?
No, I guess as far as, like, when we moved out here from, like, online to, like, in person, we did, like, we used to have, like, the occasional movie night that doesn't happen as much. But, like, we'll spend time with each other outside of practice. But realistically, like, it's hard because, like, we're one of the longer standing rosters now, is, like, the core 6 out of 7 has been together for quite some time. So it's, as far as, like, making changes, like, I've only sat through X amount of roster changes, X amount of, like, entire team changes. So I don't know if I necessarily have, like, the best solutions as far as, like, we don't, like, hold hands but around a campfire or anything like that. But
that's a shame. I'll have to call Andy and let him know.
Yeah, I try to get everybody to go hiking in the mountains here. That's been a long no for, like, a year and a half.
But... what? Okay, movie nights and mountain hikes are coming back. 2022 is your chance.
Heck yeah.
You got it. All right, next question is from Chung, and he has asked, what are the best and worst parts of the R6 community from a coaching standpoint in the pro scene?
I think the best part about the community is the passion and the support. When someone gets a team, they, like, latch to that team. And I think for, like, any esport, like, you end up with, like, toxic fan bases that are, like, super dedicated to a team. Like, those happen in, like, every sport. But, like, being able to see, like, there are a lot of, like, positive communities that grow from R6 esports that I really enjoy. I think the worst part is, as a fan, you can only see, like, a team's success based off of wins and losses. Like, you either win and you're the best team in the world, or you lose and you're just a trash team. Like, you're absolutely in the dumpster. Like, win every game in overtime, and, like, man, you suck as a team. But, like, example being, like, when I was with SSG, it was back when ties were a thing, And there was like a massive meme about like we tied like every single match that we possibly could. We'd beat like the bad teams, but then we'd tie every other team. And like we were seen as a bad team because we couldn't finish out the like out the matches, which is understandable, but then we were also able to take every team to max rounds. And I think like a lot of the players like saw like I saw like a lot of negativity like out of like individual players where it was just frustrating to them to see like we're doing like well, but we're just like we're not good in their eyes. And I think like that kind of sucks to a degree. But yeah. I think overall like the passion of the fans is almost as strong as the passion of the players, and I really love that.
That's awesome. Have you had the opportunity to be, I'm sure you have, be at an in-person tournament?
Yeah, I've been at a few, not as many as I'd like to, but hopefully we'll get those more and more again. Because, like, I think the weirdest thing is, like, I've never had to sign anything. Because before, like, I was just an analyst, or, like, nobody knew that I was working with, like, I worked with TSM for SI 2020, and nobody knew that I was. So I got to, like, just, like, meet, like, a few dedicated people that did know. But, like, at Raleigh, like, I had, like, people asking for my signature, and I was like, what is this? Like, how do you even know who I am? It was really nice, but it's definitely interesting.
Wow. Okay, well, I'm in Raleigh right now with all of your biggest fans, so next time you take a trip out here, we'll just get more autographs on your radar there. Awesome. Next question. I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
No.
Okay. Our next question is coming in from Madman, who has said in the chat that they are representative of the Emergence R6 team. So they have asked, hey Data, number one fan here, I'll give that to Madman. I was wondering what is the most efficient way to take down stats and to implement new ideas into games?
So the most efficient way for stat tracking that I found is data scraping through OCR. So like you'd kind of have to be like tech savvy or get someone that is to get like go through it. You essentially will have like a system scanning the screen to look for like the key indicators of like the operator selection screen of like the kill feed and essentially track that information. And like, that'll be the most efficient way. But reasonably, if you're going to make a system that is like isn't automated, would just be to go through the VODs and like try and like keep track of only the information that you know that you're going to use as like a beginner. It's like when I first started out, I was collecting everything and I didn't start using a lot of that information until like a year later. And it took me like 9 months to set up an automated system. So I was tracking like several hours worth of VODs for no reason until it was actually usable.
Sometimes you just gotta let it build up first, right?
Yeah. And then new ideas just comes down to strat development. Like you have like an interesting idea to work off of and you just like you build off of it. You're like, oh, like I've seen a team do this and I really want to counter that. And like that might actually be something that counters a lot more than just that. And you just spend a couple hours working on it. I'll see if Poge is okay with me releasing. I did like a counter strat for a team that became like one of our main strats a season and a half ago. I'll talk with Poge and see if I can release that sometime on Twitter. I might do like a breakdown of it and try and like give it like a better idea of like where it came from and like how it grew.
Whoa. Industry secrets. You heard it here first. Awesome. Well, we can't wait to see if you get the approval on that one. I'm sure everyone would love to see that. Our next question comes from Hail Razor Panther. And they've asked, what was the biggest challenge in developing your analytics approach?
I think the biggest challenge in developing my analytics approach was, it's hard because there's like two different challenges. So the first challenge is being that all of it was self-taught and like learning like looks like it would be easy, but then like trying to like you have like an idea, like I had like an idea of like what could be done that wasn't being done, And a lot of that was the automated system. A lot of it was the machine learning. And like, it's fantastic to have that idea, but then you're just like, oh, it'll be easy. All I have to do is like spend a couple weeks reading. And that is not the case. I'm still working on a system. Like, this system is not at all close to being complete, because it's very easy to like dive in and just like realize how deep everything goes. You have to learn how to do like coding for server-side stuff. You have to do application development. You have to get into machine learning, which is a whole thing in its own. And outside of that, I would say it is removing bias. I think it's very easy to like, do you see like, man, like we just lost like 3 games in a row on a map. Man, we must suck at this map. However, like oftentimes like, that is a very biased approach, because you have like a different way that you could be thinking about that map. You could be thinking about like why that map failed, and like you could just avoid the map, which is oftentimes where the bias like wants you to go. It's just like, well, like we should stop playing that map because we just suck at it, or like we did the same take X, Y, and Z like happened, and like we just suck at it, and like just dismiss it. But realistically, like oftentimes like a strat can be good or a map can be good for you. It's just that you have to change like your mindset, and that bias kind of clouds it.
Another great life advice piece. You're giving us all of the real life truths today as applied through R6 strategy. That's awesome. Thank you for your answer. Oh my gosh, we've gotten so many more questions, so I've lost my place. Pardon me. Okay. Pegasus, who again is from Ohio State, has asked, how do you motivate the team?
Personally, I find a lot more motivation comes through Poge than me. And that's because I'm a very like nervous person. I'm a very like quiet person as is. So like whenever like anxiety hits, like my voice is a little bit shakier. So like when you're at the Mexico Major, like, and like even stage two, like I didn't want to have to call a timeout, because I know like just like the anxiety in calling a timeout is like a lot. And like that's oftentimes like why I prefer to stay in like the secondary role as like a strategic coach, as an analyst that's not on stage. It's like you have to be like realistic with yourself on like where your strengths and weaknesses are. And like when I first joined TSM, there was like the chance for me to trial as the head coach, and I was like, I don't want to do this. Like, I'll do it for as long as we have to, but like I want to find a replacement. But as far as like motivation and like scrims and whatnot, it's just like, it's more about like making people think differently. And I like, that's where I feel like I'm a little bit stronger, is like I can make strats that make them think differently about a map. But as far as like, if it's like calling a timeout for a mental reset, like I have to like spend the entire, like it's a lot more stressful as a coach to like watch the game being played than it is for like to actually be like the player, because you're watching 5 perspectives and you're watching things go right, you're watching things go wrong. And like, I'm doing that. And then I'm also like stage two the entire time. I was like, please don't let me like have to call a timeout. I'm sitting there just like mentally preparing myself to call a timeout, which should be super simple. And like, it's something that probably gets better over time. But I definitely think like I do less of the motivation, and I leave it more for Poach and like, more for like the IGL to do more motivation than anything. If anything, I'm just like I make a bunch of bad jokes, and that changes their mindset, I guess.
That's awesome. I think our next question really feeds into this. It's also coming from Ohio State. How do you handle issues or conflict with the team?
I think so. As a team, we've only had like a few of those like daunting big conversations, like a couple times in the past 2 years, like 2.5 years. Like, we're fairly self-sustaining when it comes to like issues. We don't have like the big issues come up. Like, we've had like after Mexico, like we had like a big discussion, and like middle of last stage we had a big discussion, and like those were just because like we were trying to make changes that we didn't have enough time to make those changes for, and like that creates a lot of stress. And like those ended up being like, they start out as like tense questions that you don't want to like ask, or you don't want to hear like asked, but like they're questions that need to be asked, and oftentimes they come out in a healthy way. I think the team, like, naturally, we get an issue and we just like bring it up and we're like, yep, we're gonna work on this, and then it gets worked on and fixed. And, like, the big issues are typically things that are like, they're not necessarily like, oh yeah, like, we'll just fix that, because that's not necessarily how easy issues are. But, like, overall, like, I think the team just naturally, like, we have a core roster that, like, works really well together. And, like, we just, like, cycle through it, I guess.
Helps when you don't have a lot of conflict on the team.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Awesome. Lucky is back with another question, and they've asked, how did you get into the esports industry in regards to a deep learning analyst? Oh, how did you become a deep learning analyst? And can you tell us your story that would show your start in deep learning to where you are now?
So as far as how I got here, initially I wasn't doing deep analytics. I did heat mapping for CSGO, but that was probably the closest thing that I had before. But when I first got in, I had like zero connection, zero like everybody that isn't in the scene or like wants to be like higher up in the scene will always say that it's about connections for getting a job. But nobody knew who I was, and I think like that had like a big impact on like how I grew. But as far as deep learning, I didn't start that until a couple months after joining, and a lot of that just was, it came from an idea of just like, I see how like other teams are doing it. Like, I saw like a few videos about how like some European like coaches were doing things, and I saw like a few things where it's like, well, they're doing sort of like the baseline of where I'm at now, but I definitely think like if other teams are doing that, like how much further can you go beyond that? And I guess I can't give like too much information on like our system. I can't get too much information on like how I do things. What I can say is, if you have an idea, even if you don't think like you can get anywhere with it now, like, you work on that idea until you can like present it to someone, and you have to give them like the reasons why something is viable and why you are needed. It's like, I've been shut down by teams. Like, when I left SSG, like, I shut off my system to like a few other teams, and like the teams wanted it. The teams like, this is fantastic. But even beyond that, it's like, I had to prove not just to them, but to the organizations they worked for, that I was worth it. So like a few orgs were like, they already had like a subscription, like the pro subscription for CGG, and like now they have to choose between like spending only $1,000 a month or however much it is for CGG versus like paying my salary. Like, mm-hmm. It definitely changed where I landed. Cause like TSM, like, as much as like I love the team that I work with, and like this is like by far like the best roster that I've gotten the chance to work with, they like weren't necessarily the first option, because originally I was planning to leave North America. But like a lot of the orgs in other regions, like, their allocation is definitely like not towards like deep analytics. So I don't necessarily have like a good story other than like how you can market yourself for like deep learning.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, marketing yourself is like just as big a task as having all of the skills, and like having that ability to sell yourself. Yeah. It's definitely unique in your field for sure, but can apply to many other jobs and industries as well. And there's always going to be so many applicants. Just that alone can definitely be daunting for people. So learning how to sell and market yourself is an excellent skill to have. All right. Our next question comes back in from Ohio State, and they've asked, what do you tell the team during timeouts? I have a feeling this is going to be another "it depends" question.
So there are two different ways that you can approach a timeout. It does depend. Depending on the team, sometimes you need to point something out that's like strategic, in the sense of like, all right, guys, like, what you're doing is fantastic, but like, they're doing like these takes, you can give recommendations on like what strategies to try, what adjustments to make. But the one that comes out more often than not is more about the mental. Like, a lot of it becomes more about like trying to help like emotionally stabilize people, mentally reset people, like trying to get them in like the right mindset to win the next few rounds. I think a lot of players, when they, like, things get really tense, it's easy to just like burn out, and like you have to have like some sort of like typically like you play like a ranked game and you're stressed out, you just walk away, but like you don't have that in a match, and like the coach has to provide that reset for the players, and more often than not, that's where everything goes. Is like you'll want to like try and like amp a player up, you want to try and like get a player to calm down. Sometimes like a player's too overhyped, they're too overzealous, you need to like have them take a chill pill. Other times you need to like try and amp someone up, you got to like get someone to have like a posture check. It'll depend on like the individual players, it'll depend on the team, it'll depend on like everything, depending on like what's happening in the match. But those are the big two. It's just like you're either like giving strategic advice or you're just giving a mental reset.
Do you have any preferred strategies for that mental reset, or a funny or great example?
For me, no. I think I've only taken like 3 timeouts, like consistently, and often, more often than not, like I'll provide like one line of like, all right, like this is like how like we need to change the flow, and like this is what I see what's happening. But more often than not, like I prefer to just let the, and I think a lot of coaches prefer to let the players talk it out. Like just having like being like, all right, like here's an idea, but you guys talk about it. It allows the discussion to like kind of grow, and like oftentimes like getting the players engaged in that manner, like just like they're like looking for you to say something, and you just take a step back and like force them to have to communicate. Like they're there for it. Like they needed that time. And more often than not, you see a lot more success when they're able to just talk it out themselves than anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Well, we've got some more questions for you here and about 15 minutes left, so I'll keep trucking through them. Next one comes in from, I will, hold on, we got more questions. My gosh, I've lost my place again. Okay, next one is also from Ohio State. What do you look for when holding tryouts, and how important is a player's rank?
So we haven't had to do tryouts in a long while. I think our last tryout was for Chala, and before we even we knew we needed to, Ubisoft was making a coach change where you had to have 2 coaches to be in the pilot program, like to be in tier 1. So we knew we needed another coach on, like we'd already known because I didn't want to be the head coach. But like we knew we needed one by a certain date, and we couldn't find any coaches that could do like what we needed. And we knew that Hoge could do like what we needed. So initially, like we were looking for head coaches, and we couldn't find anybody that would fit our qualifications. So we were going to move Poach to head coach because we knew it was a lot easier to find supports than it was to find a coach. And my main recommendation was Chala, because he had, like, I had already worked with him on SSG. I knew where his strengths were. I knew where his weaknesses were. And we actually watched, we basically talked through our options, and like we had like, before we even like went through a list, it was like, all right, let's look through, like let's like kind of watch, like let's watch his last Challenge League game and like see, like we weren't necessarily looking for him to pop off the way that he did in his last match, but it was like he was the only person on his team that was droning. He's the only person that was like, and he wasn't on a support role either. Like he was playing the flex role. He's playing Sophia on Cafe, I think. So he's playing that flex role, and he's the only person that was droning. He was the only person you could see like working with other people like consistently just through the gameplay. And that would be the same stuff that we would look through for a tryout. Cause like, yeah, like technically we were trying him out like for that period, but like realistically that just became scrims. We look for people to be team players. We look for people to be communicative. We look for people that are like, they're willing to work with other people, and like, you can tell that they're not going to shut down over a long period of time. Oftentimes there's what we call a honeymoon phase, which is typically when a team does really well when they have a new player, because they have to work through the basics. And oftentimes it'll be how quickly you work through those basics. As far as rank, I don't think rank matters. As dumb as it sounds, like it is a baseline, but if you look at it, last season I didn't play ranked. Chala didn't play ranked, Matt didn't play ranked because of how bad like the state is. So like if anybody's trying to like use ranked as an like a justification for how like good or bad a player is, like it might be good for lower tier like teams because you don't have that much to go off of. But realistically, like once you get past a certain point, like you at least need, like, if a player's in plat 3 or plat 2, like, they're good enough to be, like, tried out for, just because at that point, typically, they're going to know the basics, and you're able to see in those first couple of tryouts if they're, like, worth it skill-wise. So I think rank depends, but, like, after a certain point, it doesn't matter, because people are going to stop playing ranked when there's, like, a big issue that Siege has right now.
Mm. Yeah, well, your response really feeds well into the next question, also from Ohio State, which is, how seriously do you take Tier 2 and Tier 3 teams or players? How do the skills at each level differ?
I think, so, versus, like, Tier 1 to Tier 2, there's, like, a massive gap. And oftentimes that is, like, how much of a team player someone is, or, like, outright, like, the, like, mechanical skill and, like, the consistency behind it is what matters. But I don't think, like, we'll prep Tier 2 and Tier 3 just the same as Tier 1. If anything, we have smaller sample size, or, like, when it comes to Tier 3, we're more likely to go through, like, their rank stats to, like, see what operators they play. Just because a lot of, like, lower tier players are more likely to play what they play in competitive and ranked, just because, like, they want that edge to get higher in ranked, and, like, it's understandable. But I don't think we take them any less. We might take Tier 3 less the same than, like, Tier 1, but oftentimes we'll take Tier 2, like, just as serious as Tier 1, depending on, like, how, like, close our practice is. It's like, if we've had a practice before where we have had practice before where we just flawless, like, every single map against a Tier 2 team, and, like, we're less likely to practice against them. And that's not necessarily because they're Tier 2, it's just because they're not a team that, we're a good team to, like, counter them. But, like, we'll still, like, we value Tier 2 just as much as we value some Tier 1 teams. And when it comes to, like, players, like, if we had to pick up a player, like, we look through, like, every region, we look through every league, like, we're going to, like, prep ourselves for, like, every level, whether it's picking up a player or playing against a player. And then the skill levels typically is Tier 3 is people that aren't necessarily, like, they either aren't old enough to perform in Tier 2, and it depends on if it's, like, typically, I used to say, Tier 2 is typically deemed as Nationals, Tier 3 is, or Tier 2 is Challenger, and the Tier 3 is Nationals, but in NA, Tier 3 is, like, the Community Leagues. I think a lot of the Community League players aren't necessarily good teammates, whereas Tier 2, they're a little bit better, but when it comes to, like, Nationals teams are a lot better than Community at being teammates, which is why you see a lot of, like, EU Challenger League being a lot better than NA Challenger League. Is just that they, like, they stay together, they're able to, like, be teammates, and I think, like, that, like, reflects on those levels as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Just giving us all of the knowledge here. We do have a few questions left. What are your thoughts on the current competitive scene? How would you change it?
So I think the competitive scene is interesting because we've always wanted change, but we've never known how to change it. I think adding in the point system globally isn't bad. I think they need to find a way to filter it out through region. And then I also think that we need playoffs after each stage to qualify for majors. So what a lot of the, I would say, like, the LCS and LEC, what they do is the top four teams in a region go into the, like, the upper bracket, and then you essentially have the, like, the bottom two feed into the bottom bracket. And I think that we could do that for a lot of the regions. So, like, we had, like, let's say, like, the example for this major is, like, us, DZ, Sonics, or I guess SSG, OXG, Sonics, and DZ playing in the upper bracket. We can go through the losers bracket with Mirage for Sweden. And, like, that might be, like, seen as, like, oh, like, you're just upset that you didn't make it. But I do think, like, since the majors are best of threes, it'd be better to try and, like, give, like, a system that, and, like, a tournament type system to kind of, like, give those teams that are at the end of the season to like get a chance on that? Because like a lot of teams, like if you look at like Exet's first couple games, Exet being like one of the bottom tier teams in the league that's potentially getting relegated, they had a few bad games, like really bad games the first like half of the split, but then they were actually not doing that bad towards the end. And I think like if they'd been given a chance, like through a system like that, even though they wouldn't have qualified anyways, I think a lot of teams like do worse in the beginning of a season, especially like the teams that are like newer together, like if they've just made a roster change. And if you had like a system, it would kind of like feed through. And I think like doing that for majors would be really interesting, because then it would give teams like, it would give the viewers like a system that allows you to like see like how a team does. And like the example being Latin America, they do a similar system where they have the top six from Brazil go in, and they have from South America and Mexico, they have some teams go in. And one of the top teams from Brazil that was expected to go in is Team Liquid, and they got knocked out of the tournament early and they weren't able to go to the major. And like, I think it was fairly reflective of like how they were as a team and their consistency. And I think like, as much as it sucks, I think DC's a good team, but I think like they have like, they've got a lot more that they need to work on, because they're like right now they're seen as like a team that's like more like bit of cheese things in the region. So they're going to be really good, or at least they should be really good at best of ones. And like they're a team that's much better if they're able to practice against a team. So like they're able to do well in region, but when it comes to out of region, they might suffer. And I think that like once like teams get into like playing against that cheese, they're less likely to like have a bad performance against them. So you might see like Mirage, you might see like every team that like lost to DZ, I think has a better chance at beating them just off of how they're playing now. And I think like this is the current system just allows like teams like that, that like necessarily aren't bad, but like won't do well internationally, like by playing that way, at least for, like, from my like professional opinion, like that's not like successful in this meta, like globally. I think like it'll filter out those teams a lot more, which I think would be interesting, as well as we get like seven matches as like a stage to qualify for a major, whereas before we had back when it was ESL, it was 14 matches to qualify for a major, the Pro League Finals, or cat attacking me, or it was like the last season was at round robin better GSL best of threes to like filter top four to top four. And then now we're into a system where you just play seven maps. And like we literally had a stage where we played two teams and like we pretty much played the same amount of maps, which was ridiculous. I know that was kind of lengthy, but
no, it sounds like a lot. do you have time for two more questions while your cat is attacking you?
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. Well, I will ask you the last two questions then. How do you practice and scrim meaningfully? How do you know you're actually getting better when you're inconsistent?
I think even if you're having like bad performances in scrims, it doesn't necessarily make it a bad scrim. The only time a scrim is bad is whenever leave me alone. she is currently working on cable management right now, apparently. I guess like a lot of people see, oh, like we didn't do well in a scrim, we must be bad, or like it was a bad scrim. But like those are the best scrims. Like more often than not, like last stage we had like an entire week where we did like 11 O's every single scrim map, like when we made the change for Chala to be IGL, and like you think it bodes well for match day, and then like we get rolled on some of those match days. Whereas like we've seen a lot of like the scrims where like they are close lead to better match days, because we know like we need to tighten up on certain areas. So I guess like they become meaningful whenever you're not making big mistakes, and whenever you're able to like, when you're losing rounds off of those nitpicky mistakes, because more often than not, that's where you're losing, like you're more consistently going to lose those matches on match day than you are those big mistakes, because you're more likely to focus on those big mistakes. Whereas like if you let those like smaller ones go under the radar, that's where you really get screwed up. And how do you know when you're actually getting better when you're inconsistent? I guess the biggest thing is, like, you have to build consistency in some degree. So, like, you might have inconsistent performances, but then you have to build, like, a consistent schedule. You have to build a consistent play style. You have to build consistency when you're feeling inconsistent. So it's like you have to build a better foundation to build, like, a higher building. Like, you have to, like, if your building's just toppling over, that means that you have a bad foundation. Whereas, like, you build that consistency up, and, like, even if, like, individually, like, a player might not be performing well, like, if they're able to, like, reduce all the values and variables down to, like, something that can be tracked, then you can track what is going wrong. And I think, like, that's something that everybody could do, is, like, you build up, like, a good morning routine, like, even beyond just practice. It's like, you can build up a good morning routine that will, like, allow you to, like, know how you're, like, starting your day. You could build up, like, a good practice routine, and, like, you build up, like, you know, like, your posture whenever you're going to play. Like, you, like, if you're having, like, inconsistency in aim, you, like, you put your arm on the table in a certain spot. You don't put it there. You put it, like, you put your elbow, like, into your chest so that you have some sort of consistency to work off of. You, like, take pictures of, like, how you're holding your mouse, and, like, you, like, every time you come to practice, you, like, put your hand in that position just so that, like, you can get used to it. And then eventually, like, you don't have to look at those pictures because your hand just feels, it become more natural. And, like, you have to do that for every, like, every instance that you can, if you want to get better. Like, you don't have to, but, like, it will help. And, like, it's very good for, like, someone at the beginning. It's just, like, give yourself that foundation.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you for sharing all of these facts with us, all of this inside knowledge. I've got one last question for you before we end this stream. The last few questions, by the way, have all been from Ohio State, as well as this last one. How do you balance what the meta is and what your team prefers? Do you choose specific operators or setups that aren't meta?
I think that's a very good question. So I think the biggest thing is, at the end of each season, the team develops, like, we develop strats based off of what we expect the meta to be. But more often than not, like, it comes down to practice. Like let's say, like we adapt fairly well to, like, the utility meta. We adapt, like, so, like, the adaptability meta, we try and, like, work as a team to, like, shift to the meta, but, like, there are always going to be, like, those certain things that you do over, like, a long period of time where it's just, like, it is a comfort pick. Like, let's say, like, Cali on Cafe, like, Beau, like, that isn't something that we necessarily, like, it's good, like, Cali's good, but more often than not, she's a detriment to the team. But, like, we know, like, Beau, like, feels comfortable playing her on that map, so, like, we give him the opportunity to. And, like, more often than not, like, we'll design stuff for the meta, and we'll design stuff, like, in, like, the middle ground of, like, what is going to be viable, but, like, what do we know, like, the team, like, will, like, feel comfortable doing, and, like, how do we, like, transfer their comfort over to what will be more, like, viable for a match. But I guess it becomes about professionalism in a sense of, like, the team isn't just be like, well, we're not going to change because that doesn't feel comfortable. Like, that's how you start losing a lot, is, and, like, over a long period of time, is, like, the meta, you're like, oh, like, we'll keep doing our thing because eventually the meta will favor us if we do this, and, like, that's not how it works. Like, that's how you lose a team, is by, like, not being able to change. And then as far as choosing, like, certain operators might be meta, but more often than not, like, we'll have, like, a projection of what the meta is and what it will be, and we can kind of push that. Like, we were the first person out of APAC, or the first team out of APAC, to kind of push Finca into the meta, and we got a lot of criticism for it initially, but, like, now she's considered meta, and, like, even though before, like, it just depends on, like, how other people see her, is, like, you're doing things for a certain reason, and as long as you have that reason, it doesn't matter if it's meta or not, because it could become meta, like, overnight, for all you know.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Data. This was an awesome Q&A. Everyone who has stuck around to the end, thank you so much. Everyone who asked questions, thank you. Just, we appreciate you being here. And Data, what an awesome guest you were. Any parting words for the audience?
Well, thank you to everybody who asked questions. Thank you to Madman for being my number one fan, I guess. I guess just thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak here. It's always interesting.
Awesome. Yes. Thank you guys. Thank you guys. Thanks for joining. Make sure that you join the Discord. It is discord.gg/TSMU. Next week, there is no Q&A episode because it is Thanksgiving in the US. So be sure to follow the channel so that you know the next time we are live. But again, next week, there's no Q&A. Data, thank you so much for being here. And thank you for all of your wisdom and knowledge. I know it is much appreciated by the chat and by everyone who's been viewing. Have a great night, everyone.